Salutations, friends, and welcome back to The Arcade. We are your video game podcast here with you for the week of Friday, March 3rd of the year 2017. How's it going, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, children of all ages? I am Mike the Legend, who's a bit nasally this week. Forgive me. I am coming off a cold, and I was, well, thankfully I'm not forced to have a Hall's candy in my lozenge. Excuse me. It's a lozenge, not a candy. in my mouth this week as I record, so it makes it much easier to speak and enunciate, unlike last week, which was kind of a hard slog to get through, but we persevered and we gave it 110%, didn't we?
Yes, we did indeed, as I will be giving it 110% this week, as it's now my turn this week to have a cold. This week I'm Dennis, the man who can now truly proclaim that he is a homeowner.
Oh, weren't you saying in September that you were a homeowner?
Yes, but, you know, somehow you don't quite feel like a homeowner until you've had to deal with a minor crisis. In my case, it was the furnace not blowing hot air.
Ooh, that's a problem.
Yes, it was a very cold house for about a day, roughly about a day, and a bit of a panic, and actually getting really good service by a local service guy who works for ComfortTech. Gotta recommend them.
All right, then.
He's not paying me, but, you know, it's good service. So if you're in Winnipeg, hey.
Free shameless plug, but that's all right. Hopefully this will lead to some sort of sponsorship deal between The Arcade, a video game podcast, and
a furnace company. Yeah, but sure. But less of a company, and I think it's just one guy, maybe two guys. Small business.
That's okay.
Gotta support small business. But yes, you definitely feel like an adult when you're like, oh, I need to actually talk to someone about my furnace.
I need to call a repairman for something.
It's like, huh. Okay.
Well. Yep. You've crossed that threshold when you've had to worry about major home appliances.
Yes.
Not just a microwave on the fritz or something that you can kind of deal with, but
it's like, no, I've bought microwave before. It's fine. That's not a big deal. Like, that's a Safeway, It's like Canadian Tire-ish trip or something. You just, whatever, but.
A furnace. You can't just go buy that off the shelf.
No, you sure can't. That's part of your house is what that is.
It is an integral part. And
of course, depending on where you're from, where we're from, it certainly is.
As we are currently, well, even though we're still in, well, late February, early March, Old Man Winter still will not release us from his icy cold grip.
No, he's a real jerk.
Yeah. I mean, it's bright and sunny outside. Haven't had snow in a while, that's awesome, but hey, it's still cold.
Yeah, it's still cold AF, as the kids would say.
And so you do need that furnace, otherwise you're basically going to become the Ice King.
Yep, pretty much.
Crazy beard and all.
Yes.
Well, you're halfway there.
I am working on it. I'm still working on it.
Unchanged from last week, except
true.
Incrementally longer.
Yes, incrementally longer. There's incrementally more beard from last week, and that's how beards work, I suppose.
Huh.
The passage of time equals more beard.
I'm learning so much.
Yes, of course, depending on your ability to grow and stuff, whatever. But, yeah, for me, it works.
Now, if only you had some sort of chart to, you know, hold up to the side of your beard and just, you know, chart its growth.
I'm currently at a 5.2. It's like, what does that mean?
Ooh.
It's the beard scale. Or something.
Some sort of metric with which to measure beards. But, well, thankfully your furnace is back up and running and blowing hot air.
Yes, and knocking on whatever fake wood this desk is made out of, hoping that nothing goes wrong in a little while.
Hopefully you can make through the winter.
Yes, before any other major appliances have to be replaced or fixed. But yes.
But when they go, they're all going together.
I hope not. That would really suck. That would be a hell of a lot of money.
Sure would be. Time to do some things you'll regret.
Will I?
Won't you? Won't you?
Will I?
But anyways. That's a discussion for another podcast entirely.
Yes, it sure is.
As I said, we are The Arcade, your video game podcast, and we are here to talk about video games, and we will get to that in just a brief moment, but we have one item that we want to speak of before that. that kind of takes us to the world of science going crazy, which we haven't dabbled in too much this year so far.
No, we haven't. It's actually been a pretty consistent year for crazy video game related news or general technology news or whatever, at the very least, which is nice. But, you know, anytime a super crazy science story comes across the wire, we feel like we have to talk about it, and there hasn't really been something this crazy yet this year.
No, it's kind of been on the down low, I guess surpassed by the crazy that's been happening in the global political sphere.
That as well, yep.
But we do have a story that is certainly worth talking about, and on the one hand reminds us of some of the projects and attempts and innovations that Nikola Tesla tried to make back in his day when he roamed this earth in corporeal form.
Yes, man who was maybe 100 years ahead of its time, maybe more than 100 years ahead of his time. Probably more than 100.
In and around there.
Somewhere around
and
there, yes.
And a current company that is an absolute mega multinational corporation that has its tendrils in so many different fields, but you wouldn't think those tendrils extend to science and research, but they do.
Yes. Which, in a way, sort of is a bit of a relief that they're doing something with their insane wealth, other than just accumulating more wealth. So, we mentioned Tesla. Tesla did a lot of things that you might not realize, and there's a whole topic for another podcast, I'm sure. Probably other podcasts, other documentaries have been made, that really talk about the achievements of Tesla and how he kind of got screwed over a lot in his day by Edison, amongst other people, etc. But his main goal was always just basically trying to supply the globe with free power.
Yes.
And the most feasible way that he sought to do that was wirelessly. Now you might be thinking, doesn't that seem dangerous? This is like, it could, yeah, if not done right. But he was smart. He was onto something, but it was just not feasible at the time. But Disney, being a company that we were, you know, mentioning as having its tendrils and everything, decided to sort of run with that recently.
Somehow, one of their research teams, I guess, has been working on this, and they've devised a way to deliver power wirelessly. Now, this isn't quite at the scale that Tesla was envisioning of a global wireless free energy type grid.
Yeah.
Instead, it is still on a very small scale. And what the Disney researchers have found and been able to do is to deliver energy wirelessly just in a small enclosed room, just emanating throughout the room, the energy waves, if you wish to picture them in that way. They've been able to deliver around 1900 watts of energy, in a room with an efficiency that varies between 40 to 95%. So there's a wide range of efficiency, in there.
Apparently, of course, depending on the position, angles, whatever, you know, energy waves go in different ways, I'm sure, kind of like microwaves or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So it's probably something similar to like when you heat a burrito or something in a microwave and part of it's cold. That's the 40% efficiency part. The hot parts on the outside, those are the 95% efficient parts. So it's probably it might sound dumb, but it's probably a similar thing to that.
Entirely possible. Now, having said that, you might think, okay, well, the 95% part, let's focus on that. How can we just extrapolate that and make the whole room that 95% efficiency? Well, this room is actually specially designed for the purposes of trying to figure out how to deliver wireless energy. So this is not about to be a new sensation sweeping the nation in home electricity needs.
No, it's not just like some little portable thing you plug in and then all of a sudden you don't have to plug in anything else in that room. No. Essentially, the whole room needs to be built of aluminum panels all along the walls and a big ugly copper pipe right in the middle of the floor. So the room can't not be made for this purpose.
Yeah.
And it doesn't look very nice either.
No, it doesn't. Because the, you know, copper pipe, imagine, say, a telepost in your basement.
Yes.
But made of copper.
Yeah, made of, so basically, closer to like exposed plumbing, really.
Yeah. To a certain extent, in the middle of the room, and has to be ideally in the middle of the room, not off center, not at some, you know, other desirable angle. It has to be right in the middle of the room. And that, that middle of the pole, actually has a part removed and then has 15 capacitors installed in it. So you have exposed pipe and exposed electronics in there as well.
Yeah. So really looking like something out of some 1960s science fiction movie.
Or some really crappy home DIY reno project.
Yes. Or a meth lab.
Is there a difference?
I mean, that's up to you. But,
So the reason the metal, the capacitors are inside the copper, metal pole that's in the middle of the room is because they are setting a resonant frequency and isolating electric fields, that are then fed into the room from a signal generator that apparently was outputting a tone of 1.32 megahertz. And then once the system is entirely fired up, the room is blanketed in a magnetic field with a receiving coil that's tuned to the same resonant frequency, powering the various devices in the room.
Yeah, so all of those 1,900 watts of power apparently fall within American federal guidelines for a specific absorption rate, which is an amount of energy that's safe for human bodies to basically be around. So that's a plus.
It is.
It's definitely, I mean, it would put a whole damper on the system if humans couldn't be around to enjoy it, because what's the point of a whole wireless energy if you walk in and you're dead because you've just been electrocuted by the room with too much electricity?
I'm now picturing The Simpsons.
Yeah, of course. But yes, there are still caveats to this room with too much electricity, because people should not stand closer than 46 centimeters around the pole, presumably because if you stand closer to that, you are running the risk of electrocuting yourself, probably.
So it's not being used as a dance club, this room. You're not having anyone dance up on the pole. That'd be bad. Or if they are, they're not dancing on it for very long.
No. But regardless, progress is progress. And, I mean, we've taken the first step of the way there to realizing a over 100-year-old dream of a crazy man from back in the day.
This is true. And it's taken Disney to help get us there.
Yeah, Disney of all people. So tip of the hat to them.
Certainly. Their researchers did publish their findings and their paper in PLOS One, a scientific peer-reviewed journal. We have a link to it if you're interested in that sort of thing on our website, thearcadeshow.com, as well as a link to a kind of quick video description of what it is and what these researchers were able to achieve. It's an interesting idea, and we'll see if other research teams out there from other entertainment companies or post-secondary institutions are able to look at this and use this as a jumping-off point to then fine-tune and make tweaks to make it a more, A, efficient process, and B, not as specialized a process, and perhaps bring it into homes at some point.
I could actually see the Tesla company taking this and running with it.
Ooh.
I mean, along with their name being the namesake of Nikola Tesla, they do things sort of like this, or have been doing things sort of like this recently, so it'll be interesting to see what comes of this in the next couple of years.
That's true, and if they could find a way to perhaps integrate their power walls into it, or their battery systems.
Yeah.
Either to then spread the energy into a room or collect it.
Yeah, collect it would be interesting too.
It certainly would be. We'll see where this goes, but I'm sure the fruits of these labors will be 5 years down the road.
Yeah, the ever moving goalpost of technology is always 5 years away.
Yeah, just that perfect little Goldilocks zone of future where it's, you know, close enough that it's reasonable, but not so far enough in the distance that you just kind of wave your hands and forget about it.
Yeah, exactly.
That every researcher says it's 5 years away. Shut up. But we're going to shift gears now and talk about video games and a quest that one man had for the past 3 years. And
almost 5 years.
Almost 5 years.
I mean, 3 years, closer to 5 years than 0 years. So there's that.
It's true. But we are going to speak of a man named Piotr Delgado Kujelik, who also goes by the handle of the Mexican Runner. Now, we're speaking of this man because he's a speedrunner who has set about to accomplish a very ridiculous task and achieve a very ridiculous goal. We've seen the speedrunning community make attempts and set high bars for achieving ridiculous tasks, but very specific tasks in video games. Even recently, I saw someone trying to mow down all the trees in Mario Kart 64 yes. in the fastest time possible. So when these people are going after things, they have a very specific goal in mind. And so did this speedrunner, but his could not be accomplished in seconds or even minutes. His was spread out over many calendar years because his goal was to go through and beat or complete every NES game that was released for the system.
Yes. Now I believe we've talked about this before, the number, because it's kind of a staggering number, you know, when relating to people who have done collecting or whatnot, but the number of official licensed NES games that exist is 714. So that's no small task.
It is not. And that's just the number of games that were released in North America, and that's what Mr. the Mexican Runner was going by, and also tackling 35 games that were exclusive to PAL territories across the ocean. So that's 750 games that he's looking at beating. And the man finally accomplished his goal last weekend. It was, I believe, Sunday of last weekend, February 26th, that he was doing a stream where he went through and was able to complete Super Mario Brothers 3, which was the last game he had queued up and left to go through. And with its completion, he finished his quest after, 3 years, over 3,000 hours, and I believe he broke it down to minutes of 206,112 minutes.
Yes, which is 900 consecutive days if you lay all the hours out without a break. That's not how you played it, of course, but yeah. Yeah, 714 games. And yes, that did include, the 714 did include the 35.
Oh, sorry.
So that was all of the ones from the North American region as well as ones that were exclusive to PAL regions.
Very well. I misspoke.
Not counting Famicom games, of course, because that's a whole other kettle of fish that he wasn't going to get into.
No. That's a can of worms that you go even deeper into.
Yeah.
And takes a lot more time. And some of those games, even harder.
Yeah, but 714 games, that's nothing to shake a stick at.
It's certainly an impressive accomplishment and demonstrates a level of dedication to the task, to the goal that is far, far and away greater than what I have. I have many games in my NES collection that I've played only once and had to put down because they were terrible.
Yeah, well, you know, for a while there, some of us may have gone on binges where we would just see super cheap games that looked kind of bad, but were like a dollar. And you know, sometimes you just gotta spend a dollar just to, out of curiosity, just mm-hmm. to see what something's like. And oftentimes, it'll make sense why it was just a dollar.
This is true. So, as some of you may know, in playing NES games, that a lot of games for the NES, they had levels and stages and worlds that you can go through, and there's a steady logical progression that you go from start point to end point. Yet many other games on the system, say, were a puzzle game that did not have a definite end point.
No.
And it was for those games, apparently, that he would play them as far as he can and basically take them to a point where he's done everything, gone everything, and just kind of the game is repeating itself and somewhat starting over. And then he would move on to the next game, but Along the way, he also was able to set records in Battletoads and Contra, which is impressive. And
well, I think that, well, he is like Kusiochuk is kind of like he was already noted in the speedrunning community. Like he already did have records, I think, in those two items. But I guess being a speedrunner kind of puts him at being maybe better than the average person at video games anyways. Like, especially if you hold a record in a game, that sort of proves that you are good at least one game. So, I guess that was the impetus for this, for him. But yeah, some of them, like, must have just been weird trying to figure out how you can consider them done. Because I believe one of them was a Miracle Piano teaching system, which, you know, they said took longer to beat than most RPGs. I'm assuming to consider a game like that beat, you have to do maybe play every single song that's maybe in the game or something. I don't specifically know how the game works, but if it's a piano teaching game, you pretty much have to learn how to play piano to beat it. Isn't that it?
You would think so, yes.
But yeah.
And in my experience, there are just some NES games that are somewhat impossible to play because they're terrible, and the game that immediately comes to mind when I say that is Captain Planet.
Oh my god. Yeah, I mean, like, you can beat it, but it has
Can you?
Probably, yeah. I mean, an average person can't because, I mean, the hitbox is way too big and, everything's hitbox is way too big and very clunky and it's just generally not a well put together game.
It is not. The level design makes it tremendously difficult to get through.
Yeah. But speedrunners are a different breed. I know that.
This is true. This is what we're experiencing as we learn more and more and hear more and more of these crazy accomplishments coming out of the world of speedrunning. So certainly our hats off to the Mexican runner, Mr. Piotr Delgado Kujalik. Apologies if we mispronounce your name.
Which we probably did. I think it's Peter Kusielczyk, probably.
The Mexican runner.
Yes, he calls himself the Mexican runner, even though his name is clearly Polish to me. Or it's not, and I'm just don't know what I'm talking about, which is also possible. Kudos to you, the Mexican runner. Kudos.
Mexican and Polish.
Probably Polish. Probably also maybe Mexican. He calls himself that. It's a confusing thing all around. But he beat 714 games.
I will never come close to that, so
no.
Good on you for even being able to withstand the very terrible ones, like the Rambo game.
Oh my god. Or probably some of like...
The Dirty Harry game.
The Terminator game, or the Total Recall game.
Oh.
Some of those games where your character's way too big on the screen.
Mm-hmm.
You know? That's a whole genre that was oddly pervasive amongst game translations of action movies. But, yeah.
Just out of curiosity, I'm going to muse this aloud because the thought just came to me, but I'm wondering if the number of NES games he completed also takes into account the non-officially licensed games, like the Tengen games or the Wisdom Tree games.
I don't think Wisdom Tree would count. I think Tengen are licensed, but the Wisdom Tree games I don't think were, so they probably weren't counted. Just like also all those various 55-in-1 whatever games. I mean, Action 52 was officially licensed, but it's a weird game anyways. But yeah, none of those weird Chinese knockoff games were probably in there either. So
that would, to me, that would have made the accomplishment even more impressive because those games are, the Wisdom Tree games are literally unplayable.
Yeah.
Sometimes even broken, just outright broken.
Yep. Hilarious sometimes if you're, you know, a bit of a heathen like Mike the Legend or myself.
They're good for a laugh.
Yes. But
so those are the two ludicrous lead-off items that we have for you this week. And as I said off the top, this program is for the week of Friday, March 3rd. It is being posted in the morning on Friday, March 3rd. And March 3rd is also the day that Nintendo takes a big step. They release their brand new system into the world, the Nintendo Switch. If you've been able to pre-order one, you are no doubt excited for this weekend to go to whatever retailer and get yours or have it delivered to you through whatever means you've acquired it. But if you are just out there and do not have a pre-order and perhaps are thinking of getting one on this weekend, the launch weekend, well, we're here to give you a bit of a primer on what you can expect when you go looking into the world of the Nintendo Switch. Now, we know the some of the basics, but we'll cover some other areas that you might not know, and we'll give you prices for things as well and let you know what to expect, so that way you do not get sticker shock when you go to the store and see how much some of these things are going to cost, because not cheap.
No, not cheap at all.
This is certainly appearing to be Nintendo's most expensive console to date, not just in terms of what the system is costing, but as well the prices for some of the games and the accessories as well.
Yeah, definitely right in line with, well, current other generation consoles in price, I would say, because the Nintendo Switch itself, which includes one console, one docking station, one Joy-Con.
Sorry, two Joy-Cons.
Sorry, two Joy-Cons, which, you know, the left and right ones that strap onto the console, one Joy-Con grip controller, as well as 1 5-foot HDMI cable and the AC adapter altogether. So basically just the bare necessities of what you need to play the console altogether is going to be $299.99 US or $399.99 Canadian. So $400 Canadian.
Yes, which is kind of expensive for a, you know, system right off the hop.
Yeah. I mean, granted, it is launch price, so of course that will come down, but that's also about as expensive, I think, as the PlayStation 4 as well as the Xbox One sort of were when they launched.
It is, and probably around the same price as what you can find for some bundles of the PlayStation 4 or Xbox One.
Yeah, or more expensive than some bundles. I mean, I picked up the Uncharted bundle. I mean, granted, it was a Boxing Day sale, but I picked up the Uncharted bundle, PlayStation 4. I mean, it wasn't the Pro, it was just like the Slim or whatever, but that was $329.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I think the regular price of that was $379, which is $20 less than this. And it comes with, you know, really one of like the premier AAA games that are out there right now, of Uncharted 4. So that's kind of a little bit interesting.
It is. If it matters to you, you can get two I guess, types of system, kind of harkening back to what Nintendo used to do back in the day with the N64 and somewhat into the GameCube days, not so much with the Wii or the Wii U, but colors for the systems. You have one set where it comes with, you know, just standard kind of gunmetal cobalt gray Joy-Cons left or right, or you can get another set where the Joy-Cons are neon red and neon blue, not your choice of all neon red or all neon blue. No, one is neon red. The other Joy-Con is neon blue.
Yes, and of course,
they look atrocious.
Yeah. And they are a matched pair, so it's not like you can get entirely blue or entirely red. No, they only have like the one side red, the one side blue. I don't think they have sets where you can mix and match it up.
Not necessarily, although if you were so inclined and if you wanted an only red Nintendo Switch with the all red Joy-Cons, both on the left and right side, you can purchase individual Joy-Cons separately of varying colors, be they red, blue, or the gray, for $64.99. That's Canadian dollars, by the way. Every amount we're giving, unless otherwise specified, is Canadian dollars, because we're here in Canada. And if you're listening to us in America, it's cheaper. It's cheaper for you, so screw you.
Yeah. The exchange rate is not that drastic, so say what you will, but we're getting ripped off.
We are. Hosed out the nose. So again, if you just want an individual Joy-Con controller, say you lose yours, misplace yours, drop it, it's in your pocket and goes through the wash or something, $64.99 for a replacement individual Joy-Con.
Yeah.
but that's accessories. We'll talk more about that later. The big thing, of course, when any system comes out, the question is, what does it have in the way of games?
Yeah, because you can't buy a system if there's no games for it. There's no point in buying that.
Exactly.
So the launch titles, you know, we've talked a little bit about it in the past on, you know, in the past few weeks in this program, but there are a good number of, well, a decent number of launch titles, not huge amount, but there are launch titles. Of course, the top one, of course, being Legend of Zelda Breath of the Wild, which has a couple of different bundles available and ranging in price from $80 to $130.
Yes, the $130 bundle comes with a statue as well.
Yeah.
I believe there's a $100 bundle that just comes with some extra artwork and whatever else, soundtrack, and then just the $80 set is just the basic game.
Yeah.
From there, the other main title being put out by Nintendo for the launch of the Switch is something called 1-2 Switch, which I hate the name.
It's a bad name, but it might be interesting. It sort of channels WarioWare or the WarioWare games, because it's sort of like a collection of small, silly, mini games that sort of just use the motion controls of the Joy-Cons.
It does. That one's going to cost you $65. Ubisoft is represented in the launch titles by bringing out Just Dance 2017. That's a $60 title. A surprising name to see in the launch title list is Bomberman, with a new Bomberman game called Super Bomberman R. That's a $70 title.
Yep.
And elsewhere there are various other ports, such as Just Dance 2017, as well Activision bringing Skylanders Imaginators to the system. That's a $60 game after it's been released on everything else.
Yeah.
Although, that's actually the only console game, console Skylanders game Activision's doing this year.
Yeah, which is maybe a bit of a gamble on their part, but
kind of funny, if you ask me.
Yeah, ports include I Am Setsuna, the Square Enix Chrono Trigger Love Letter for $40, as well as Shovel Knight Treasure Trove.
That's actually the first release of Treasure Trove, which is their all three bundle for Shovel Knight Classic.
Right.
The second one, which name escapes me, and Spectre of Torment.
Yeah.
So basically it's all three games released from Yacht Club Games.
Yeah, so the first release of a port of three games.
But I believe this is the first launch for the third game.
Okay.
But it's coming to every other system as well. But yeah. As well, there's a futuristic racing game called Fast RMX, which kind of looks to be in the vein of, say, a Wipeout or an F-Zero. That's $25. And as well, a smaller, kind of more interesting, quirky game called Snipper Clips Cut It Out Together.
Which, of course, I can't help but think of Full House with the dumb line of Uncle Joey, but we don't need to go there.
That one is going to cost you around $28. Now, we also know that Nintendo has the eShop as well for purchasing games from the digital platform, and there are a few titles, but not many available for that.
Yeah, not many, as in only five, really. The first one being World of Goo, another one being Little Inferno, another one called Human Resource Machine, which looks kind of interesting. One called New Frontier Days, Founding Pioneer, as well as Vroom in the Night Sky.
Which is an indie title that features a witch driving around on a motorcycle.
Yes.
Figure that one out. Now, those are the ones that are kind of more exclusive to the eShop. Games like Breath of the Wild and I believe 1-2 Switch and some others will also be available for download from the Nintendo eShop. But be wary about how much you download from the eShop.
Yes, because, we've said it before, there's only 32 gigs of internal storage, and Breath of the Wild by itself takes up half of that, so.
Roughly half.
So, you know, keep that in mind.
Indeed. So when you're going out and about picking up all you need for your Nintendo Switch, be sure to pick up a micro SD card or micro SDXC card, because you will need to expand the capacity of the storage on the system.
Yes.
And remember, as we said, it's 32 gigs on board, but you don't get all of that a good portion is reserved for the system OS itself.
Yeah.
And now, granted, I mean, micro SD cards aren't the most expensive thing in the world.
No, they're not the cheapest thing either. And also, they're sort of, because they're miniaturized technology, they're currently limited in what they have space-wise.
True.
I mean, it is expandable up to 2 terabytes, but a 2 terabyte micro SD card is going to be ridiculously expensive at this point.
It is. It certainly is, and very cost prohibitive. If you look around, I just did a quick search on Amazon, I believe last night, and I was able to find 128 gig SD cards for like 20, 30 bucks.
Were those SD cards or micro SD cards?
I'm going to have to double check. Yes. I was simply focused on the capacity of them, but yes. Do some searching around and, I mean, you can find deals. You can often find deals on memory.
Yeah. You'll just go wherever there are phone accessories too, because micro SD phones, it's a thing.
That's true.
Or at micro SD XC as well, because that's the newer format.
That's true. And the Switch will support the SD XC, format, and you can get some more capacity out of those than you can on your normal micro SD cards. But, that's an accessory you'll just kind of have to look for and figure out on your own. There aren't any official Nintendo accessories that are micro SD or SD XC cards. You'll find one that suits you and is at the best price point. But if you are looking to buy actual first-party Nintendo-branded accessories, well, we spoke of one already, the individual Joy-Con controller. That's $65.
Yeah, or if you want to get the pair, it'll run you 100 Canadian bucks.
Which is goddamn.
That's crazy.
It is. But if you don't want to play with those small little Joy-Cons and you want a more traditional game controller in your hand for a more traditional game experience, either as you're sitting on your couch with the Switch docked to your TV, or hell, even if you're just, say, on the go and you've brought the Switch with you to your hotel room when you're out of town working.
And you have it on a stand or something.
Yes, and you just want it with you and you want the Pro Controller, the Nintendo-branded Pro Controller is $90, again, Canadian. Or if you're just kind of, well, grimacing at paying that amount for the Pro Controller and you'll just kind of grin and bear it with the Joy-Cons, the system does come with that grip controller, which kind of makes the Joy-Cons into a more traditional controller form factor.
Yes, but that's not a charging grip.
It is not.
You have to buy the charging grip separately.
It is.
Which is going to be $40. And which is a little bit of a contentious point with a lot of people, that the out-of-the-box grip is not a charging grip. It does not charge the controllers. All it does is hold them into a shape.
It does.
So, yeah.
That's kind of bunk. If you perhaps lose it or want an additional AC adapter for wherever other place you are taking your Switch, that is also going to cost you $40. And as the Switch is a portable device, you'll be taking it on the go, on the bus, on the train, on the airplane, in a car, in a boat, on a goat, what have you.
Yes.
You will need some kind of carrying case, some sort of protection for this device, because it's still an electronic. And you want to keep it good, considering the investment you're making with everything here.
Yes.
So the Nintendo-branded Switch carrying case and screen protector, that's going to cost you $25. And if you want additional Joy-Con controller wrist straps, those are $10 a piece.
Yes. I would definitely not get the official Nintendo case and screen protector. There are companies that have been making cell phone and tablet cases and screen protectors online for years at this point who will be able to provide you a much better price than $25. So just keep that in mind. Unless, of course, you need to have the official Nintendo everything. But, yeah.
So, and that's just what you're going to have to pay. What happens when you get it home and, or hell, get it to your car or whatever the case may be and you fire it up? What can you expect? Well, there's a day one update to the system, which brings with it and enables on your machine the ability for it to access the Nintendo eShop and, if you wish, download whichever one of the, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 titles onto the system. That's cool.
But there's no other online services, essentially, yet.
No.
So there is no virtual console and also no word of any virtual console to be spoken of yet.
There has not even been a breath of when we can expect an announcement about virtual console for the Nintendo Switch.
Yeah, which has some people kind of scratching their heads a bit, understandably so, but also having, well, at least me scratching my head, even though I know that literally everything plays Netflix now, but it's because everything plays Netflix, you have to expect everything to play Netflix. So there will be no video services just yet on the Switch, including Netflix, Hulu, Amazon Video, whatever, Show Me,
Crave, YouTube.
None of those things are going to be available on the Switch.
And I mentioned YouTube there as a video service because, well, it's a video service.
It's the video service, arguably.
People just come to expect and, you know, will watch their videos on. If you want to access it through the Switch, fat chance because there's no web browser either.
Yep. There's also no online multiplayer yet.
And when it comes to any sort of official Nintendo online service, Tatsumi Kimishima did say at the January unveiling of the Switch and what it was and what it was all about and what it would do and gave us more details, did say that there would be a paid online service coming for the system later in 2017. Since that date, since mid-January, we've heard nothing more.
Yeah.
Again, similar to the virtual console, not even a breath of when we will learn more.
Yeah. So this might sound like we're ragging on Nintendo, but it's all right there.
These are facts.
If the facts make it look like we're ragging on them, unfortunately, that's just how it is.
This is just a primer to make you a more informed consumer as you're going out there. If you want the Switch regardless, and that is its unique selling point is something that appeals to you, more power to you.
Yeah. By all means, be our guest. There's nothing necessarily inherently wrong with being an early adopter of things.
Sometimes. Every technology has them.
Yeah. I mean, there are certain advantages and bragging rights you get as being an early adopter, but just sort of general caution, if you were sort of on the fence, probably a good time to wait.
Certainly. The device itself, as we've spoken before, we'll just quickly run over. It has a 6.2-inch capacitive touchscreen. So when it's just kind of in tablet mode, it's the screen is
not very big.
Not very big, and it's doing 1080 by 720.
Yeah.
And when it's in the dock, it can output up to 1080p, though some other games will run at 900p.
Yeah. So definitely not future-proofed either, I would say.
Well, 4K is still, I'd say, a couple of years away from mass adoption.
Yep. So, but we could see the same thing with the Wii, as we did with the Wii. It was the only system that didn't have HD, and it was sort of quickly left behind.
Well, there is that too.
So, not that, again, we've said it several times. I don't think either of us think that 4K will necessarily be mass adopted anytime soon, because the jump from 1080 to 4K, it's noticeable. But it's not like the jump from going from a CRT to an HDTV.
It is not drastic.
No. So, yeah. So it's probably fine, but, you know, again, just a word of caution.
It is. And certainly it's something to be aware of, and there's nothing saying that in, you know, Nintendo can't in future upgrade the docking station to do 4K.
Yeah, exactly.
So.
Unless, of course, there is some sort of prohibitive hardware thing with the Switch. But I guess we'll have to cross that bridge when we get to it, won't we?
We certainly will. And if you're looking at using the Switch more for its portability, because it is, you know, wanting to do console gaming on the go, the battery life can vary from 2.5 to 3 hours for a game like Breath of the Wild, a much more intense experience, or, I guess, lighter, not as processor-heavy experiences, say like Snipper Clips or what have you, will, or even Shovel Knight, will get you maybe upwards of 6 hours. Still not a lot, but there's a USB-C charging port on the base of the system.
Yeah, so it'll charge fast at the very least.
It will, and there's a number of, you know, USB-C to AC adapters out there.
Yep.
Additional power bricks or whatever.
If you are like me and have a Nexus 6P, you will have gotten one for free with your phone.
Oh.
Yes.
Well, aren't you fancy?
I am. Me and my good Android phone.
So that is what you need to be aware of when you're out there. There are, you know, Nintendo just, I believe, last week held a indie showcase, you know, listing off some of the, you know, independent games that would be coming to the Switch through the year. A lot of them look to be ports, or if not ports, then or straight up ports, then it's, you know, kind of some new features added to an old game or whatever, which is an interesting idea. But a lot of what was shown off in that Nintendo video were games that didn't have specific release dates. And this is one of the problems with Nintendo, with the Nintendo Switch, and what a lot
Maybe with Nintendo currently, I would say that's fair to say.
True. I guess with both Nintendo and the Switch is that, while there may be a number of games coming, we don't really know when. And this is the problem I'm finding with the Switch, is that we don't know a lot.
No, everything seems kind of rushed.
Rushed? Or just kind of...
like a figure-it-out-later kind of approach.
A little bit, yes. Like, they just kind of want the unique selling point of its portability to be what carries it. And that will be enough to you know, woo consumers. And some, it will woo them, and that's totally okay. Others will want a more fleshed-out idea presented to them of what they're getting into.
Yeah.
And, which is also understandable and natural. When Xbox One and PlayStation 4 came out, we kind of knew what we were getting into better, say with online services.
Yeah, they were very upfront with things like specs, online services. I mean, both of them, mind you, PlayStation and Xbox have had kind of ingrained online services for at least a generation at this point. So, you know, you have your PlayStation Plus, you have your Xbox Live. It's not really a surprise when they say, yep, we're going to have PlayStation Plus and Xbox Live, but it was ready at the launch. I mean, online gaming is sort of an important thing to a lot of people now, especially if they want to consider something like Splatoon kind of picking up like Overwatch. You'll need an online gaming platform for that.
You certainly will. And, oh, that's another point that I wanted to mention. As we did say, I believe, last week or week before, you can connect basically up to 10 Nintendo Switch devices together for local LAN playing.
Yeah.
For a game like Splatoon 2. But there's no specific date when Splatoon 2 comes out. It's just listed as summer.
No. But that's also just for LAN play too. Is that as prevalent now as it maybe was 15 years ago?
I don't know.
I mean, that's... yeah.
And we also do know that Super Mario Odyssey, the new Mario game, listed with a fall release window. Where that will exactly come out, September, October, November, we don't know yet. I kind of get the sense that we'll know more come the summertime.
Like, yeah.
It just has to get out there at first.
Yeah.
And their big thing is we're getting it out the door.
Yeah, they have to be that annoying guy on any internet forum that has comments on it to be the guy that just writes first.
Yeah.
So it's like, great. That doesn't mean best, but at least you got in there first.
And as much as it may have sounded like we were ragging on Nintendo and the Switch, I mean, facts are facts, but it still looks like a neat little device that has a very unique selling point when compared to PlayStation 4 and Xbox One.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not as sold because I feel like it's just sort of like a combination of a few things that we've seen already.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, I still need to see it in action. And before I do that, I need to see more games and better prices.
That's true, too.
So, I'm obviously taking a guarded approach to this. This is not my first rodeo. I've been bitten by hype before.
It's true. And time will tell how it all shakes down. I know myself, I'm taking a guarded approach. I'm almost of the mindset by this point, and likely, you know, shouldn't say almost, I am of the mindset at this point that I think I'm going to wait, not just, you know, for a couple months. I might wait for the first hardware, like redesign or revision, a year or two in.
Yeah, I mean, I kind of do that these days with systems anyway. I didn't pick up my PlayStation 4 until the second version of the PlayStation 4s came out, because honestly, that's when the price drops are really going to happen and stuff. And by that point, there's going to be a good library of games to choose from.
Mm-hmm.
So, but again, I'm not an early adopter anymore.
No, those days have long passed me by.
Yeah. But, I mean, by all means, if you are an early adopter and you do pick up the Switch this weekend, please let us know what your opinions of the Switch are. info@thearcadeshow.com is our email. Drop us a line on Twitter.
We are at The Arcade Show and on Facebook, facebook.com/TheArcadeShow. Let us know your experiences with it. Were you able to get one? Did you have a pre-order? Were you able to get one without a pre-order? Because once the pre-orders went live, after the Nintendo presentation of it in January, a lot of retailers kind of sold out of their initial pre-order stock, but we don't know if they got any more pre-orders made available to them, anything of that nature. So just let us know where you're able to find one in the wild. How do you feel about the price point of the system as well? Do you feel that it's offering enough considering the prices you're having to pay?
Yeah.
Is that good value for your money, do you feel? So let us know all that, and we'll certainly keep you apprised of more Switch developments as they come out, but I kind of feel like it's just going to be all quiet from Nintendo till E3.
Could be when they release their Treehouse thing or whatever it is.
Video presentation.
Yeah, whatever they call it at the time.
Yeah. And we'll get a better idea of things at that point because they will hopefully be building towards a solid holiday, retail season.
Yeah.
And give us more than just have more to offer us than just Mario, which, I mean, Mario does look awesome.
Yeah, the new Mario game does look great.
And Breath of the Wild, from all of what we're seeing in the reviews of it coming out, lives up to the hype that it's put out.
Yeah, a lot of 10 out of 10 reviews that I've seen for Breath of the Wild, which is kind of unheard of any game. And it's poised to sort of, like, according to certain game aggregator scores websites, like Metagamer, or Open Critic, sort of the Metacritic sort of replacement. As soon as it's released, it's going to be the top-rated game on the site.
Which is impressive.
Which is really impressive, just immediately jumping over everything, including, Grand Theft Auto V, which is otherwise the highest-rated game, as well as a few other things like Witcher 3 and
Journey, Flower,
artistic things like that. So, I mean, I definitely can't wait to play it. It's going to be quite an experience, I'm sure. But we'll have to see.
And certainly. And the reviews coming out of the system itself that I've seen so far, I mean, the consensus seems to be that, yes, it's a unique selling point. It delivers on the unique selling point, and it's actually really awesome to be able to play a fully fleshed out kind of AAA console game experience like a Zelda Breath of the Wild on the go.
Yeah.
And it actually does transfer from the screen to the dock in your TV amazingly quick.
Which is good.
But a lot of it also seems to be just wait.
Yes.
So wait and see. But if you get in there lickety-split, let us know how it works out for you. But there's other game consoles out there, and you might have one of them. You might have an Xbox One out there, and Microsoft is looking for more ways to monetize the system and get money from you for the Xbox One. You might be already paying for the Xbox Live Gold membership, upwards of $60+ per year, and they're releasing a new service that if you're interested in, you can pay $10 US for per month. It's coming in the spring, and it's called the Xbox Game Pass.
Yeah, so it's very interesting. It sort of piqued my interest for sure. It's essentially Netflix for Xbox games. I mean, you might think, like, wait, like, how? So the way it works is, according to a quote on the Microsoft blog, well, MajorNelson.com. Major Nelson is a Microsoft employee.
He is. He's, I believe, the head of the marketing and communications department.
Yes, but on his blog, he wrote, and I quote, "Play games across multiple genres from action-adventure and family favorites to shooters, sport, puzzle games, and more. And with new titles added every month, you'll always have a wide selection of great games to choose from. Games are downloaded directly to your console and play online or offline in full fidelity without any streaming or connectivity issues." And going on later to say that people who subscribe to this service will also be given a 20% discount on actually purchasing a game from the catalog, and 10% off all related add-ons. So whether or not that part is interesting to you or not is up in the air, I guess, but paying a flat fee for basically a rotating list of games that you can just sort of swap out at any time.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, of course, like Netflix, subject to availability, things will kind of come and go, I'm sure. But
indeed. And I believe even if you've downloaded it, if it's off the service, I believe it won't necessarily function.
Yeah, but that's fine. I mean, that's if that's sort of expected to start with, I'm okay with that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it kind of brings us, I think a service like that is kind of brings us closer back to the old idea of going to rent games from a rental place.
It's reminding me almost of the Sega Channel.
That as well. Like an interesting mix of the two. And I think if more companies offered a service like this, it could be good in general.
Certainly. PlayStation maybe kind of sort of has something with the PlayStation Now, though that is primarily for older games.
Yeah.
From the PlayStation 3, and it's a streaming service. And the rates can be kind of hellish.
Insane.
Choose your adjective.
Yes, I would say insane. But, you know, being a PlayStation guy myself, normally, well, I'm not a PlayStation guy, this is the one I picked.
Yeah.
I have more friends who have PlayStation. That's all it is. That's what it boiled down to. And it just had a couple more games I wanted to play on it. That's it. But, you know, this sort of makes me look at the Xbox and go,
It's a very interesting idea, and a $10 a month price point is, you know, reasonable, puts it in line with a Netflix, you know, style service.
Yeah.
Or other video services out there that people have already demonstrated, comfort and willingness to pay.
Yeah. I mean, it also sort of goes back to the only reason why a lot of people pirate stuff is because of, like, the crazy prices of even, like, certain online services. Like, I think Netflix has proved that given the right price point, even people who are normally pirates will have no problem just saying, yeah, for the convenience, sure.
Mm-hmm.
It gives me all of the benefits of piracy, but without any of the drawbacks of, like, you know, having to piddle around with license keys and, you know, putting yourself at risk of viruses and stuff.
It's true. Into that uncertain world. And this is actually a neat idea, and I wonder if we'll see other companies come out, or other major console companies come out with something similar. Will Sony kind of follow suit and kind of re-envision what the PlayStation Now service could be?
I would be interested in that.
I'd like to see Nintendo take a similar approach like this with their classics.
Yes, hopefully. That would be really nice if that's sort of what the virtual console ends up being, where you just get carte blanche access every month to whatever game you want, but maybe you only have a certain number of slots and maybe they're subject to monthly availability or something. But that would be nice if that's what it is.
Mm-hmm. I'd also like to see, say like Microsoft, roll this service in and kind of bundle it or try to a la carte it with the Xbox Live Gold membership. Because if you're playing a game, say like Halo 5 Guardians, which has online multiplayer that you've downloaded from the Xbox Game Pass, you still need that Gold membership to play the online multiplayer aspect of
it. Yeah.
So you're paying $60 or, you know, however much per month, $60 per year, for that one membership plus the membership to this Xbox Game Pass. So you're paying two fees to have all features for one title, which to me, I don't know. That strikes me as
a little bit of a ripoff.
Kind of. Yeah. But, if say Microsoft was to, like I said, take a piecemeal or offer up a piecemeal approach where somebody could sign up for an Xbox Live Gold membership and they can pick and choose what they want, and this being one of them, and then they are charged accordingly.
Almost like selecting a cable plan with a television company or something.
Yes.
But maybe better than that.
Less cumbersome, onerous, pricey, what have you.
Giving you things you don't want, bundled in with things you want.
Exactly. Like, oh, if you're, you know, selecting the online multiplayer, you'll also have to then get this other crap.
Yeah.
Which I can't imagine what the equivalent of unwanted channels would be in the game sphere.
Yeah. Like, okay, I get all these home and garden channels and, like, whatever, all I wanted was this one music channel. Why is there five, like, gardening channels and the golf channel in with this? I don't... Why?
But, that's an interesting idea. That's, I wonder how much of a hand Phil Spencer had, a hand in developing that idea, because he's taking a more gamer-centric focus to Microsoft, or to the Xbox, since he's taken over that whole division.
And it definitely shows, I think.
Yeah, he's become a lot more consumer-friendly, certainly more so than his, predecessor, Don Matrick, and even more so than, say, Peter Moore, who used to be the old head of the Xbox division back in the day.
Yeah.
Kind of was the head of it back in the Red Ring of Death days.
Yes.
For the Xbox 360.
But these days he was heading up, he was acting as the chief competition officer for Electronic Arts. But those days are coming to a close for him as well. He's moving on to a very interesting and unexpected new venture for himself. I don't think any of us would have necessarily seen it coming, but,
I didn't. I was very surprised by this.
Yes, but this, he's deciding to move on from EA, and he's moving on to, join the Liverpool Football Club as the new chief executive officer.
He's moving out of games entirely.
Not entirely. He's moving to one game. He's moving to, We call it soccer, but I guess it's football to the rest of the world. Footy to the rest of the world. He's moving into the soccer market, acting as CEO for the Liverpool FC.
Yes, which to him is actually kind of a lifelong dream come true, because was actually born in Liverpool and has been a lifelong fan of Liverpool FC. So this is actually kind of a big deal.
Yeah.
For him. And he will be taking over, I believe, in June. In the summertime, he'll be leaving EA and going over there. And if that opportunity comes along, you have to take it.
Yeah.
That's like, you know, if someone was to leave Ubisoft Montreal to take a high-ranking position with the Canadiens.
Yeah, exactly. It's almost the exact same kind of thing. Like, I mean, of course, it wouldn't make sense if you don't care at all about the Canadiens, or if you're not really a sports fan or whatever, but if you are... You gotta follow your dreams, man.
It's true. And those opportunities do not come along often.
Yeah, exactly. So when they do, take them. And Peter Moore is a man that knows how to take opportunities. I mean, ever since the days of Sega, like he started off with Sega, moved on to Microsoft, moved on to Electronic Arts. Three pretty good moves, I would say.
It is. So he spent a number of years in the video game realm.
Yes, always following the next big opportunity. But I guess it gets to a point when it's just like, if you are a fan of something and you see an opportunity to become involved with that organization, you go. And yeah.
So a tip of the hat to him for being able to land that gig, because something like that, it's a prestigious role, and there is a lot of competition for it.
That is true.
And one last news item we're going to get to here on this week's edition of The Arcade. We know the popularity of streaming, live streaming, game streaming, how it's really, really kind of become, I guess, more commonplace over the past number of years.
Yeah.
With something like Twitch, which it started life as a platform for people to do their game streaming and has then expanded to kind of be a more all-encompassing entertainment hub.
Yeah, I mean... It's taken the place of like where, well, it's sort of, supplemented anyways, live events on television perhaps, but also sort of, fostered the whole e-gaming, your e-sports movement a little bit more than television would have ever done.
Mm-hmm.
So it's been a source of entertainment for a lot of people, a source of live entertainment, I should say, for a lot of people for a while at this point.
It certainly has. Well, even also, I believe last year, diversifying and getting into things like,
rebroadcasting The Joy of Painting.
Yes. And also The Joy of Cooking.
Yep.
With Julie Child, that entire old series. And, so it's just kind of there, and it's trying to cement itself even further as being a, platform for, you know, to draw more eyeballs and
a viable broadcasting platform.
Yes.
That's alternative to TV, but also something that people would want to pay for, because they have launched premium subscriber packages that you can subscribe to.
They have, and any broadcaster, anyone who really wants to draw eyeballs to either their channel, their station, their service, needs personalities, and needs hosts, entertainers that will attract eyeballs to them, and Twitch, certainly, no different than that, because it's a platform available to pretty much anybody. Anybody can hop on and do a game stream and get eyeballs that way, but now it's offering those game streamers the chance to actually make some money off what they're doing. Because recently, Twitch put out, I guess, a post on their blog that stated that starting in the spring, so just in a couple months' time, they will start allowing streamers to sell digital PC games through their stream and monetizing that service. Now, we should also point out and quickly state that the streamer themselves, the individual behind it, the person that you're watching, from whom you can buy the game, isn't getting a heck of a lot. They're getting something.
Yeah, they're getting a 5% cut from the developer, who receives 70%. The remaining 25% goes to Twitch. And that's not just any streamer who's selling games. That's only partnered streamers.
Yes.
So people who are already sort of like hired on in some capacity to provide regular content for Twitch, who they're making some money from Twitch, but maybe not like PewDiePie money or something like that.
No. When he was back in his heyday.
Yeah.
Don't know if he's making PewDiePie money now.
No, I think he screwed a little bit of that up, but, that's a whole other thing we won't bother getting into right now.
This is true, but, it also has to be, I guess a game that, is agreed to by a publisher to be sold through the service, and some of the publishers who've already agreed to this, development from Twitch are Ubisoft, Telltale Games, Paradox Interactive, Hi-Rez Studios, just to name a few. And as I said, it's going to come out in the spring. And so far, the pricing has only been made available in US dollars. Regional price tags will start appearing later this year. So an interesting idea put forward for, I guess, creating another revenue stream for these streaming public. In addition to, I guess, Patreon and other donation sites and what have you.
Yeah.
Actually, and you know, while we're speaking of Patreon, and we still have time, I said the Twitch story would be the last one. Calling an audible here, that's okay, because we're speaking of Patreon and contributing to things that you like.
This sort of will transition nicely into our final segment in a second, the Blast from the Past, which we always talk about at the end of the show. But the Blast from the Past's focus is always kind of bringing out things that are celebrating some sort of historical landmark, things from the past that, you know, we think you should put your eyeballs on. And there's a lot of stuff from the past, especially with video games at this point. It's got a 40-year history at this point.
Mm-hmm.
And there is a foundation group, or a nonprofit group, called the Video Game History Foundation that their entire MO is to preserve the history of the video game industry, because, you know, history is worth preserving.
It is, and how can we properly understand and appreciate it if so much of it is lost to time?
Yes.
Then it just kind of becomes fables and lore.
Yeah.
Without physical artifacts to point to and say, no, see, this says X, Y, and Z.
Yeah, but as a nonprofit group, you know, like any nonprofit group, it's hard to kind of keep doing what you're doing without any sort of capital, without any sort of money whatsoever. I mean, the goodness of people's hearts only goes so far. The best hearted of people need to sleep sometime, really. as such, they have launched a Patreon page where they explain that they go on their whole spiel telling everyone about what they are,
mm-hmm.
again, dedicated to figuring out how to save as much video game history as they can and make it accessible to everyone, where their goal is to make sure that storytellers have what they need to be able to tell the story of video games. They're already working through a tremendous backlog of incredible material.
The group is headed up by Frank Cifaldi, who's been in the video game industry for a very long time. He was a writer at 1UP.com when that was a site.
As well as Gamasutra.
Gamasutra. He's been around for a while. Also launched, he was a developer actually working on the Mega Man Legacy Collection.
Yep.
And he launched the website Lost Levels back in 2003 to catalog information about unreleased video games. So he has a passion for archiving and the history of games and an appreciation for it. And perhaps there is something to be said about having a nonprofit group whose entire MO is just to search out, research, discover and preserve the history of video games. Perhaps they can be better equipped to do it rather than just a museum that's looking to do an exhibit or whatnot.
Yeah.
There is a video game museum at, I believe, the Strong Museum of Play in Rochester, New York, but that's just a museum. You need as many groups out there as possible.
Indeed.
And so right now their goal is, small. They've, they're really just working through digitizing, I guess, any sort of print physical material, be it a magazine, game instruction manual, covers, or, print ads, or developer notes, sketches, anything related to the development of games, and they just want to digitize it and have it for generations to come, so it's kept safe. And this is, I think, one of the aspects that we don't really speak of or find discussed too often in the world of video games because the medium itself is so forward focused.
Yeah.
Is that we're always looking for the next big thing, what's new, what's hot, the Switch, PlayStation 4, what have you. But what is the preservation effort? Because without keeping an eye towards preserving things for historical records or research purposes, a lot of what can go into developing games or even games themselves can be lost to time.
Yeah, totally lost to time, forgotten about. And again, I mean, there's that classic lesson of those who don't know their history are doomed to repeat it. You know, if we forget about video game history, we will forget about failures and things that just didn't work as well in the past too. So there are a number of reasons why we should keep history alive, mm-hmm. just in general, not just video game history, but if video games are a part of culture now, they're obviously an important part of culture that they've been going for as long as they have, and anything that's been going for as long as, video games have been going, it's definitely worth preserving. And, I mean, I feel like it would be a shame, if in 50 years some kid just getting into video games would never be able to play, like, the first Mario Brothers game or Tetris or Pong or something. Like, that would be kind of a shame to just have that information lost to time. Now, granted, there are other sort of services out there that try to do things like that as well, like the Wikimedia Foundation and whatnot. But, again, these are all nonprofit organizations, and it all comes back to if you want someone to do something right, you should probably pay them for it. So, Frank, that's what Frank Cifaldi's trying to do.
Mm-hmm. They're trying to make this a full-time effort, and they need the funding. They need ultimately the financial support in order to make this their full-time effort, their full-time focus and energy, and dedicate themselves to this effort, which I certainly think is worth it. And especially in these days when we seem to have more materials out there, I mean, so much of it is digital. Whereas, I guess, back in the early days, say, of the planning for Super Mario Brothers and whatnot, that was done on grid paper, whereas now everything is, CAD drawings, 3D modeling and whatnot, when it's just easy for files to be deleted or, hard drives erased or whatever else.
Yeah.
Just to make room for the next game to be worked on or whatever else. So there needs to be an eye to this. Just so we know what the hell there is. And I'd recommend watching the pitch video for the Video Game History Foundation because, Frank Cifaldi just kind of goes around showing some of the items he's acquired, through his years as being an archivist and historian for video games. And whatever room he's got all this stuff in is impressive. And I want to go to that room. because he has so much crazy crap in there. Yes. And at least watch the video for that so you can just appreciate what he's got going on and think about contributing to them as well. If this is something that you feel is important as well, we'll post a link to it on our website, thearcadeshow.com, where we keep all the show notes for every show. We'll also tweet about it again on our Twitter page at thearcadeshow and on Facebook, facebook.com/thearcadeshow.
But yes, just like the Video Game History Foundation, we like to sort of remind you of things from the past to check out or try, because can't remember everything, but neither can we, but every now and then we'll remember things, and then we'll also try to remind you of things as well. And this week we have a couple of, they're not video games, they're movies, but they're still movies that are sort of worth watching or are worth talking about at the very least for one reason or another.
They are, and we're speaking about them because they are both very much of the time in which they were made and released. One is very 80s, the other very 90s.
Yes.
One is a ridiculous over-the-top buddy cop action movie. The other kind of a somewhat fictionalized biographical documentary about a media personality who came to great prominence and celebrity in the latter part of the 90s.
Yes. We could probably talk about the newer of the movies first, I think.
Okay, well, we're going back to March 7th of 1997, because that was the day that Private Parts was released to theaters. Private Parts was the name of the movie focused on Howard Stern, radio shock jock at the time. FM radio shock jock at the time. Private Parts also was the name of his biography that came out a couple of years prior, I believe in 1993. And this was, well, Howard Stern became a really big media personality in the late 90s.
Yeah. If you don't know who Howard Stern is, I don't believe you. You've probably heard of Howard Stern at the very least. He's, you know, was sort of like at the forefront of anti-censorship and pro-free speech and stuff in the 90s. And
because he was so often getting into trouble with, I believe, the federal broadcast censors and regulators in the United States, because he was on terrestrial FM radio, which was subject to those regulations.
Yes, exactly. But yeah, as a movie, it's worth a watch, but I think the most interesting thing about this is also something that I think is interesting about that whole era anyways, that the soundtrack, I think, is arguably more memorable than the movie. I mean, I have the soundtrack and I listen to it a bunch. It was an interesting, weird snapshot in time where a bunch of artists of the time kind of got together and did weird collaborations, covers, original music, just whatever else. It was just, they made a bunch of stuff for this soundtrack. I mean, you would have Typo Negative with Ozzy Osbourne singing, doing a cover of Pictures of Matchstick Men. You had the Red Hot Chili Peppers being fronted by not Anthony Kiedis, but LL Cool J. You had like a bunch of other, you know, interesting things like that as well. I listened to the soundtrack a bunch, and it sort of reminds me of other similar type albums, like just efforts that seem to only happen in the 90s and don't really happen in such a wide scale anymore, like the Beavis and Butthead Experience album.
Yes.
You know, again, like had a number of like interstitial Beavis and Butthead audio skits tying a bunch of songs that were just, I associate them with that soundtrack. You know, other albums, like at least in the metal world, there were the Nativity and Black albums, the Black Sabbath tribute albums, put, you know, where it was like a snapshot of like 90s metal in like two different parts, like the first one being like an absolute classic album to me, even though I know it's all covers, but yeah.
Well, certainly music playing a big part in, you know, the Howard Stern movie, because he was well, a jock or shock jock on FM radio at the time, which would have to play music in between. And so notable in that regard, but also notable because this was one of the rare times where the actual person the movie was about was playing themselves.
Yes.
With no prior acting experience, Howard Stern played himself in his own movie.
Yes.
Which is crazy.
And it sure was. And he played himself at in different eras of his own career. And he actually kind of makes self-aware comments being like, yeah, you can ignore how I look. It's like, just ignore how old I look in this scene kind of thing. It's like, what? Because he narrated the movie as well.
Indeed, he did. And just wild in that regard. And the fact he was even starring in his own movie is what just kind of launched him and cemented him as a true media star at that point. And then followed, I guess, a couple years after with his big move off FM radio into satellite radio, when he got not just a show, but hell, a couple channels on Sirius or XM radio. And
yeah, he's
been a mainstay there ever since.
Yep. And of course, translating that also to YouTube and stuff now.
True.
But, yeah, it's worth watching if only just to see like the, maybe a little bit of a fictionalized version. I'm sure it didn't quite happen the way they say it happened, but.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, gotta zazz some things up for the movie, for the big screen. A number of cameos in the movie as well, from David Letterman to, just a slew of people, because, well, David Letterman, because Howard Stern was a frequent guest on the David Letterman show.
Yep.
Being in New York, they're good New York friends.
Absolutely. But yeah, I mean, also, again, I can't understate the soundtrack. Even for the songs that weren't specifically made for the soundtrack, it was just a great mix of stuff. Like, you know, they had Pinhead by the Ramones, I Want You to Want Me by Cheap Trick, you know, Jamie's Crying, Van Halen, other stuff by, like, Ted Nugent, Green Day, Marilyn Manson, AC/DC on there as well. Again, tied together with interstitial bits, some from the movie, some, I guess, from historical parts of his radio show and whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
But just, yeah, it's worth a listen as well at this point.
It certainly is, as a look back into the 90s, because the 90s are in vogue once again.
It's true.
They never really truly went away. And to some extent, the 80s are back in fashion as well, because if you turn on TV, I believe on Wednesday nights to Fox, you can watch a show called Lethal Weapon about two cops in Los Angeles. One's just kind of the wild, unhinged, maniac type guy, and the other one's kind of the older, more veteran cop of the two who tries to, you know, calm down the wild maniac, but gets sucked in unwillingly into adventure and chaos. And
yes,
might think, oh, this is a, you know, kind of a crazy show. How did they come up with it? Well, they looked back 30 years.
Yes, to a wildly successful movie franchise. And I would say ultimately probably the best buddy cop franchise of all time.
I'd say so. I mean, set the standard for them.
Yeah.
We're speaking of the Lethal Weapon movie, which celebrates its 30th anniversary on March 6th of this year, but officially came out March 6th, 1987.
Yes.
And has, in the years since, been appropriated into a TV show because Hollywood now completely devoid of original ideas.
Yes, completely out of ideas. So why come up with something new when you could just mine the 80s for movies and then just make TV show versions of them?
Exactly.
But yes, the original movie, directed by Richard Donner, produced by Richard Donner, Joel Silver, starring Mel Gibson, Danny Glover, and the original movie had Gary Busey as the bad guy, in which there was actually like a fairly legit jiu-jitsu fight at the end,
mm-hmm.
where, you know, as someone who has watched some MMA in his time, when I went back and watched it after becoming more familiar with MMA, I looked at it and went, oh, those are real moves. They're doing like an arm bar. They're doing like, you know,
takedowns.
Takedowns and stuff like that. And a bit of ground and pound.
A little bit.
But yeah, Lethal Weapon. I mean, the one I watched the most was the third one. But the first one is still great. It set up all of the, you know, universe and everything, you know, the unhinged rigs, the old cop Murtaugh, who's mm-hmm. who is both too old for this shit, as he keeps saying, as well as ready to retire. But, somehow sucked into Riggs's energy.
Yeah, certainly. And trying to keep the wild Mel Gibson alive, even though he's, you know, has a death wish.
Yeah, he's suicidal and he's, you know.
He's unhinged.
He's really unhinged. He's, maybe drinking too much, smoking too much, staying up, not sleeping enough.
He experienced some things in Vietnam that he hasn't properly dealt with.
Yep.
Because, you know, his character was a Vietnam vet who actually was like a special forces operative.
Yeah, like high up special forces ops of some kind.
Yeah.
But yeah, he's contacted by one of his old Vietnam vet buddies. But yeah, so things happen when he tries to get in contact with him for real.
Yes, and ultimately they, you know, start pursuing and investigating a drug ring and try to break it up and see how high up it goes, and calamity ensues. And the reason I say it's a very 80s movie is because it's a very over-the-top action movie that we saw so often in the 80s with things like Rambo 3 or Commando or whatnot, where it's explosions aplenty.
But oh, yeah.
Unlike those ones where it was just over the top and super over the top, this one felt, I guess, a bit more...
A little bit grounded, because it was sort of, you know, still dealing with some real things like PTSD. And it, much like the first Blood movie, it dealt with PTSD in a little bit of a way, kind of like that.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of like the cartoonish over the top violence that series became.
Yet to somewhat in this movie, we see there is cartoonish over the top violence.
Oh yeah.
And some of the explosions are crazy. And I mean, this is a bloody movie.
Sure is.
Mel Gibson's character kills a lot of people.
Yep. He sure does.
But that being said, he does have a moral center and they are bad guys, but yeah. He just kills a whole lot. He shoots first and he doesn't even ask. That's yeah. What we can say about his character in Lethal Weapon.
He gets better over the series, and his friendship with Murtaugh sort of grounds him a bit more, and he becomes friends with the family and all of that stuff. But
I believe there was a fourth one that came out in the 90s.
Yeah.
With Chris Rock, that's...
I mean, it's all right, but it doesn't feel like it's as good as the first three. The first three are kind of like really good. If you like action movies, the first three Lethal Weapons should be sort of part of your repertoire.
Should be. My personal preference is the first one, just because I like how over the top Mel Gibson's character is.
Yeah.
And the focus is mainly on Riggs and Murtaugh, and you don't get the Leo Getz character later.
Yeah. But for me personally, I love the Leo Getz character as well, because I'm a big Joe Pesci fan.
And it's so against Joe Pesci's type to play that character.
Yeah. I mean, he's normally the tough guy who's playing like the crazy guy, but he's, as Leo Getz, he's somehow still Joe Pesci, but he gets to really stretch his comedic muscles a lot more. And he's got some great comedic muscles.
He does. He just never really got to use them too much when he was in feature films acting.
Yeah. I mean, beyond like Home Alone, where he's playing a cartoon character, but Lethal Weapon 3, he's not a cartoon character. Lethal Weapon, well, sorry, 2 or 3, because he's in both of them.
But,
the first one, yeah, it's a great raw introduction to, like, the main characters.
And if you're new to the franchise and you're just seeing the episodes of the series on TV, go back and watch the original that the series is kind of, you know, loosely based on, and yeah. Watch those characters. Better.
Yes, absolutely.
Just well worth your time, and the soundtrack and the score and the music in the movie, so much better.
Oh, yeah.
The guitar and the sax just punctuating various scenes. I believe Eric Clapton did the guitar in the movie, did he not?
He did for sure in the second and third. I don't think he did for the first, though. Oh,
okay.
Oh, this is... Yeah. I'm just verifying this right now.
Indeed. Well, this is what happens.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Sorry. He was part of it the whole way through. Michael Kamen, Eric Clapton, and I think in... the second, third one. Yeah, you had David Sanborn as well. So basically, Michael Kamen, Eric Clapton, David Sanborn, some really prominent English musicians, David Sanborn often doing sax with Pink Floyd, Eric Clapton being Eric Clapton, and Michael Kamen was sort of like everyone's go-to composer guy.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, from everyone from Roger Waters to Jeff Beck to really Metallica, who did S&M with Michael Kamen, etc. But yeah, he did the Lethal Weapon score, and it's those Eric Clapton guitar stings just really make everything that much better.
If you think a scene's good, then the Eric Clapton guitar sting comes in, and it puts it over the top.
Yes, every time. It's just like, yep, that maybe not was necessary, but I definitely appreciate it a lot more now.
I recall the first time watching the original Lethal Weapon movie, I then wanted those Eric Clapton guitar stings just in my life.
Just any time, like, I drop my keys, just like, looking down, like, why me?
Just making a good point in a meeting at the office.
Oh, man.
So if you're not familiar with what we're talking about, and you, again, are only familiar with the series that's been on Fox, go back. You can find it basically on anything or on DVDs for cheap or whatever other avenue you watch things through.
Yeah.
Amazon, Netflix, Hulu, what have you. And watch the original one with Mel Gibson and Danny Glover. This is Mel Gibson in his heyday of being a prominent, Hollywood, actor before he went off the deep end.
Yeah, way before he went off the deep end, before Braveheart, before Passion of the Christ, before any of those crazy endeavors, this was like him at his best.
Yes.
Just out of Mad Max, just before Crazy, right in the prime.
Well worth checking out. Danny Glover, excellent as the straight man.
Oh, yeah. I mean, and I don't think there's anyone else who can play the I'm too old for this, I'm ready to retire, when you keep bringing me back into this madness kind of role, than Danny Glover.
It's true. And if you've seen episodes of, I guess, earlier Simpsons with Rainier Wolfcastle in his McBain little movie vignettes that they do on the show.
Yeah.
The buddy cop dynamic is based on Lethal Weapon.
Yeah, sure is.
And that's what they parody in The Simpsons. So well worth checking out as it celebrates its 30th anniversary on March 6th. Again, that is Lethal Weapon, the first movie in the franchise that then set forth a TV show that someone decided to make. I don't understand. and we also mentioned Private Parts, the Howard Stern biography film that stars Howard Stern.
As Howard Stern.
And I believe it was co-produced by Howard Stern.
I think so, yes.
And not directed by Howard Stern, but,
Joel Silver.
Yes. With music by Howard Stern.
And Ivan Reitman. Yes.
Oh, yes, and Ivan Reitman as well. So that celebrates its 20th anniversary on March 7th. Certainly, if you are new to the Lethal Weapon franchise, we want to hear from you and your thoughts on it, because we love it. The original movies.
Yeah, classic franchise.
What are your thoughts on it if you're just coming to it for the first time? Email us info@thearcadeshow.com. Hit us up on Twitter @TheArcadeShow and on Facebook, facebook.com/TheArcadeShow. Let us know your thoughts on Lethal Weapon and as well the Nintendo Switch. If you're an early adopter and managed to get one this initial launch weekend, let us know your experience with it. Or if you managed to score one without a pre-order and just found it in the wild, your thoughts on it? How does it work? Does it live up to your expectations? Is it worth the money that you are shelling out for it? We want to know all that and your experiences with it, and we'll share it with the other people here on the show in the weeks ahead. And before we leave, just a reminder, as always, that you can subscribe to The Arcade. We are on iTunes and in the Google Play podcast section. All the information, the links to take you right there on our website, thearcadeshow.com. So until next week, everybody, good night.
Good night.